I want to skip through in the 10-15 minutes that we've got, skip through some important points in Cuba's history in order to do an assessment of where I think Cuba is today and what role it can play in resisting and being part of overthrowing the imperialist world in which we live. Because I think that touching on the major challenges to the revolution happening and its existence can give you a sense of the caliber of the people who are leading that process and the depth of the revolution, if you see it that way. First of all, we begin with the fact that a powerful movement was created in Cuba outside of the traditional communist movement that led a protracted revolutionary struggle that had a combination of rural guerrilla warfare, union struggles and general strikes, mass popular struggles, popular insurrection at the culminating point of that revolutionary struggle, the destruction, refusal to compromise with the old army and its attempt to do a deal at the end, and the destruction of that army, the creation of a new and popular regime that proceeded to challenge the empire, defeat the empire at the Bay of Pigs, the invasion that was planned, the defeated the counter-revolutionary groups that were established in the Escambray, expropriated the landowners and the bourgeois classes of Cuba, and in their millions, Cubans, millions of people, Cubans participated in that process through trade unions, militias, committees to defend the revolution, through the revolutionary army, all of which were popular institutions of the people. And the party that emerged was a party that was a unification of all the forces that ultimately participated in the revolutionary process from the July 26th movement, after the breaking off of the right wing of the July, or the more conservative elements of the July 26th movement, and going into opposition and exile. The Revolutionary Directorate, a student-based group of revolutionary fighters, and then at the last minute the old Communist Party decided to join. Just before the revolutionary insurrectionary victory, the old Communist Party decided to support that struggle and became part of that new party that was formed. The next biggest, these are not minor events, right? They're quite important, significant events. The biggest challenge then was not the Bay of Pigs, I don't think. The biggest challenge to the survival and integrity of the revolution came from inside the party. A faction was formed around the General Secretary, the former General Secretary of the Communist, of the, they called it the Popular Socialist Party, but it was the Communist Party, the pre-revolution Communist Party of Cuba. The general secretary of that party was a fellow by the name of Escalante. He was given the job of being the general secretary of the new party. And he began a process of promoting bureaucratization, appointment of leaders, of bureaucratic approach to popular organization, supporting privileges for those people, a forced collectivization or a forced where they were having the biggest problem in the Escambray with the counter-revolutionary groups. His response was supporting a very bureaucratic, authoritarian, and compulsory collectivization of the peasants in that region. It required a break with those people. Castro launching a struggle, going on national television, launching a struggle to defeat that bureaucratic and counter-revolutionary tendency that existed within the revolution. This was a major struggle. These people had positions of power right throughout Cuba. They had been welcomed into the revolutionary process in good faith, and it sought to corrupt, undermine, and overthrow. The ultimate thing would have been the overthrowing of the revolution in a bureaucratic and counter-revolutionary manner. They defeated that. Not many people know about this. They re-registered the membership. The decision was made that only people who were nominated by their workplace could become members of the Communist Party. Re-registered the entire membership. And 40% of the people were not readmitted to the party. They did not have the confidence of their fellow workmates. You had to be nominated from your agricultural cooperative, nominated from your workplace, nominated from your school among the teachers, nominated in the university, and so on. That there was a democratic electoral process to actually become a member of this party. They defeated that bureaucratic counter-revolutionary tendency. From day one, they have adopted, and it's actually formally part of the constitution of Cuba. I don't know the temporary constitution. I know it's the constitution that exists today. That the national interests of Cuba are subordinate to the interests of the struggles of the peoples worldwide against imperialism and for socialism. In the constitution, subordinate to that. And from day one, in my view, they have subordinated the interests of Cuba to the interests of the world struggle for socialism. They have never, and they have been offered many times, the type of, you know, you do this and we will let up on you from the empire. The empire has given them every opportunity. If only you stop being bad boys, we will be nice to you. We can trade with you. We can give you what you need. And never, even in the direst times of the revolution, and the direst times actually came, I think, in the 1990s, which I'll touch on, but the direst times of the revolution's survival and existence, did they seek that compromise? Did they seek to sell their principles or solidarity with struggles abroad in order to curry favour with the empire? The decision of Che to go to Africa was a decision to advance the revolutionary process in Africa, that Cuba could give solidarity with Africa. They gave that solidarity to the struggle of the Algerian people. They sent troops to Algeria to support Algeria in the fight against French colonialism and to defend the new nation against French colonialism. They sent troops to the Congo to link up with the radical political leader or the forces that came out of the Lumumba movement, which was the most radical political anti-imperialist movement on the continent. They sought to link up with that movement. The decision to go to Latin America was a conscious decision that they knew that the survival of the Cuban Revolution was connected to the extension of that revolutionary process around the world. The Africa thing was part of it. Latin America, of course, was the key. Latin America was the most developed part of the semi-colonial or third world. Latin America had the biggest working class movement. Latin America had some of the deepest anti-imperialist traditions and so on. They wanted to be part. They wanted to see that movement go ahead. A lot of people think, I think, in a too dismissive way, that Che failed as a Keokuk. What's it? You know, Keokuk. What's that? you know, anyway, you know, sort of, you know, tilting at Wilmers, windmills fella. Yeah, yeah, it was that sort of stuff. No, these people knew that these people were very conscious that Latin America was heading towards a revolutionary crisis. Just think what happened in Latin America in those years, in the late 60s and early 70s. You had the election of the Allende regime in 1970. You had what was called the Cordoboza and an insurrection in 69 in Argentina. You had the revolutionary upheaval in Bolivia in that 69-70 period after the killing of Che. I think this was a very conscious thing that they wanted to establish a committed revolutionary leadership that had moral authority and would be able to have that moral authority on that continent. They needed to accelerate that process. They wanted to use the authority of the Cuban Revolution and Che's own moral and political authority to be able to be in place for what they thought was going to be the explosions across that continent. They failed, but I don't think it was a foolish gamble. I think it was a conscious, very serious attempt to establish a revolutionary leadership core in a central part of the continent to draw the new generations into it. And if possible, to bypass some of the existing leaderships that were blocks on that continent and have held back revolutionary process there for the subsequent few decades. If he'd been successful, I think we might have seen different results in the Bolivia and what happened in that region of the world and the consolidation of the military dictatorships that followed. We might have had a different possible outcome. They were absolutely in solidarity. When the next breakthroughs came in 79, then came a new opportunity in Africa. A new opportunity to give their solidarity, that the newly liberated countries which they had been aided, they sent a lot of aid and advisors and all the rest of it to the liberation struggles in Mozambique, Angola and Guinea-Bissau through those years. Then they won their independence and South Africa invaded. South Africa invaded. They won their independence, South Africa invaded, and they were within 150 kilometres of Luanda. But the Angolans said, "We need help." The Cubans said, "How much?" The Angolans said, "Everything you've got." And they stripped Havana of its anti-aircraft defences. Stripped it. Took their entire anti-aircraft defences out of Havana. They sent every single thing they could in the short time flying in the planes that they had. They had to bounce around a little bit in order to get there. The Russians didn't help. The Russians didn't approve. They entirely independent decision of Cuba. And they threw some thousands of troops and stopped them. 100-odd kilometres out of Luanda, stopped that invasion, destroying the new regime, and then they stayed there defending that government against South Africa, and then a new crisis, and that took over a number of years, whatever the sacrifice, and then in 87, due to some poor advice from the Russians and East Europeans to the Angolan government, the Angolan government got its main army trapped in a place called Quito Quinavale. Same thing. Their army was trapped. South Africa had them surrounded, and they appealed to Cuba again, and Cuba again sent everything that they could to Angola to defeat the South Africans, and they defeated the South Africans in Quito Quinavale, and then they faced the problem. They were driving them back out of Angola and they were heading towards Namibia, and the South Africans had their choice. What are they going to do? You know, they were aware that they had nuclear weapons. The Cubans were aware that the South Africans had nuclear, and there was a possibility they would use them. Did they blink? No. They said that they would keep marching to the South African border. They would not stop at Namibia. They told the South Africans, "You pull out or we will keep marching to the South African border." And the South Africans said, "We give up," and negotiated the independence of Namibia. That is revolutionary diplomacy. That is putting everything, that is revolutionary politics on a world scale, and the tribute from the South African people, because that was a tremendous moral and political blow to the authority of the regime. And that's why that's why Mandela, against advice, went to Cuba very shortly after coming out to pay his tribute to the Cuban people for that. Then we had Angola. No, then we had the next revolutionary upsurge, Grenada, little old Grenada, and everyone sort of laughed at, right? Very important revolution in a Caribbean country, English-speaking Caribbean country, only 150,000 people, and the Cubans again gave them whatever they could. And of course Nicaragua and El Salvador, vicious civil war in El Salvador, and again Cuba did everything they could to aid the Nicaraguans, to aid the Salvadorans against their local ruling classes and against the attacks of the empire. Nothing that they had that these people wanted was denied them, whether it was teachers, whether it was doctors, whether it was military advisors. All of them were provided in numbers, in the tens of thousands, in order to help those revolutionaries succeed. At the end of the day, they did not. But it was not for want of the support and assistance the Cubans. The Cubans, what they do is also they don't dictate to these people. People have to make their own revolutions in that sense. They don't dictate it. They don't dictate to the and try and interfere in what, you know, they know what the I'm sure they're aware of the weaknesses and all, you know, in these things. I read one interview where they were deeply disappointed the Nicaraguans reintroduced the draft, for example. Deeply disappointed, thought this was a step in the wrong direction, that it was made again on the advice of the Russians. They said Russians were very strong, they should reintroduce the draft. This was a wrong way to fight the Contra war, you know, that they needed to base it on volunteers and militias and so on. They disagreed, but they couldn't force that on the Nicaraguans. They wouldn't even try to force that on the Nicaraguans, because that would corrupt any possibility of the Nicaraguan people being able to make their own revolution. Today, they are doing it again. Bolivia and Venezuela. Whatever you make of those processes, you know, whether you think these are blows to imperialism. These are regimes that are under attack from imperialism. These are regimes that are trying to do something for the people of their country to some degree or other. And more is needed in terms of the revolutionary process. And I think we all understand that. But you can't begin with what you want in the future. You've got to begin with what you've got today. And they begin with what they've got today. They must give this solidarity. I remember being in a group, very sectarian group, I think, in some ways, which looked at what they did in relation to Chile from what the Cubans did in a negative way from 1970 to 73. That the solidarity, you know, that this was this Communist Party, Socialist Party government of Chile was inevitably going to, you know, come apart and be overthrown, and you know that, you know, we needed a real revolution with a new revolutionary party and all the rest of it. But actually what that was, you can't suck those things out of your thumb, right? What you had was a regime that was in conflict with its local ruling class and imperialism to a degree, that with a massive working class upsurge, and they gave a lot of solidarity and support to that government, but at the same time pointed in a different direction. And if you read the speeches that Fidel gave when he went to Chile, which are fascinating, he's talking to the Chilean people and saying, are you ready for what is coming down the road? And they are going, yes. And he says, well, if I may be a little, I can't be exactly, you know, a little impolite, but yeah, I think you know, might not be, you know. I think that there, we, you know, that things are, and the gift of the, what did that mean? The gift of the AK-47 to Allende when he left. He was giving a message and doing what he could in terms of solidarity with the government, but at the same time saying you've got to prepare for more. You've got to prepare for the revolutionary confrontation that's going to be coming. And I think that a lot of those sort of discussions are going on today in relationship with Bolivia. They have sought out every right through that again. They sought out genuine leaders. Right, the day Chavez. So Chavez does this sort of coup. Right, he's a military officer and he does this bit of a tries to do this bit of a coup and it fails. Goes to jail. Makes this great speech and he goes to jail. Cubans are real. What the hell is this fella? The day he gets out of jail, he's invited to give a speech at Havana University on the history of revolutionary struggle, Latin America, and so on. They make contact, right? They forge links with genuine leaders. They did it, and you don't know where these people are going. They did it with Lula. They did it with Morales. You know, they look for the genuine leaders, and you don't know how far they're going to go. They don't know how far they're going to go, but they're always on the. You know, they don't have a preordained thing. They're looking at people, genuine struggles, genuine leaders. Genuine connections, people who actually mean something. Not the people who Marx. Marx said, "God, save me from my disciples who have the solution in their back pocket." You know, now we have the. So I'll finish with this. Now, so what do we expect them to do? Fidel's, you know, he hasn't retired. Actually, they say he's retired. He's given up his governmental jobs. You know, Fidel will not cease to be a revolutionary until they cart him off, right? He's writing. That's what he's capable of doing. He's not able to play a day-to-day role in the leadership of the government and state, but he writes. So he gives his opinions on world affairs, so he's still a participant in that sense in the revolutionary process. You'll never retire from that. But you've got the new government saying that they need to take up a whole lot of new challenges. They have survived what I said was the worst thing. With the collapse of the Soviet Union, their economy declined 30%. Right? You just think what that means. You know, the people were going hungry. On a broad scale, genuine hunger. Their average calorie intake was less than what is required to sustain a human being for some years, right? But a little bit below. They had rationing to ensure that everybody got something, right? And don't believe that the people who are in government get more. I talked, you can see that when you go there. The people who hold important positions in government have very modest homes, very modest cupboards, right, in terms of what's available. I remember one of the Colombians who is a FARC, one of the FARC leaders from Colombia. They have an office in a part of Havana, and the FARC actually had access, I think, to more money, right? Because I mean, I think they print US dollars, you know, but they had a bit more at their disposal. They would put on in their apartment block. They would put on a dinner with meat during a special period, right? And you know, and they were the only ones in the apartment block who had meat, and lots of Central Committee people lived in their apartment block, right? But they were the only people in their apartment block at that time who had meat. Central Committee, everybody else, none of them had access to meat, right? There wasn't at that particular point. That's how bad it got. This is deeply demoralizing and corroding. You can ordinary people, right? You got to have a pretty high level of consciousness to survive this sort of shit, right? They had to go through that period and come out of it, and they have done. And now they are now with their own reciprocal solidarity with Venezuela and the oil they're getting and so on. It's opening up a new possibilities for what they can do with their own revolution. So they will be making choices, difficult choices, how to do things, right? I think they made mistakes in the past, many of them, right? I don't, you know, you can't expect this, expect them not to. They adapted too much to the Soviet model in the 1970s. They say that in their economic management model. They say that this was deeply wrong. They started to rely too much on market mechanism. They started to try to get out of that in the late 80s, but then were the decline in the economy actually forced them to retreat again. But this time they're talking about these things as being real treats. I think they nationalised too much. And I think, I don't think it is smart to nationalise the shoe shy boys on the street, you know. Or the shoe repair people, they just nationalise everything in terms of and they can't run it, you know. It's a fact. They can't run it, you know. You ought to, but whatever reason, right? They will retreat on some of that. They will have to do some deals with foreign companies, you know, and they do that. They will retreat, I think, on some of the market stuff in association. But I don't think that will be a sign of them moving towards some Chinese or capitalist or free market model. No. They only retreat when they have to, in order to move forward again at another time. That is my conviction. I think that they have had a consistency in this from day one. You know, again, there was another example in the late 70s. They had the Ministry of the Interior, very powerful ministry in Cuba under the constant thing. The Ministry of Interior established its own. Never had in Cuba special shops for the bureaucracy, like Soviet Union or China, special shops for the bureaucracy, special doctors for the bureaucracy, special schools for the bureaucracy. That never existed in Cuba, except for a period of 5 years. The Ministry of Interior tried to establish them in about 75 to 80. And they were called at a Congress, boom, this has got to stop, you hand these over to your local communities, right? They had some gyms and things, you know. There was some genuine corruption, and one of them was shot. No. The head of the Ministry of the Interior actually went to jail for a period, but there were some others who were shot for the corruption. Right? They were executed for bringing the revolution into disrepute, including one of the commanders from Angola, and they said they had no choice. He ordered the execution of people in Angola for rape, execution of Cuban soldiers in Angola for rape. That was his duty at the time. He knew the consequences. He thought he was doing something, you know, he started doing some deals with some drug people, whatever it was. He was caught, and he was punished, and he was executed. And they had a real problem with corruption inside the Ministry of the Interior, and they brought it to an end through jailing a few people, through executing a few people, and through a public rectification process as to where they were going wrong. I'm confident, hopeful and confident, that if they've been able to do that for the last half century, able to survive all those challenges, able to rise to the occasion when it's needed, that we've got to be hopeful for the future. Cheers. Yeah.